Episode 1 of Season 16, I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in my home in Ben Lomond, California is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a programmer. He's also a pedant and a curmudgeon. And I feel guilty every week saying that, but welcome, Miles.
Is that where I am? Like, you just put a bag over my head and hauled me someplace. I just figured, you know.
Give you a good room with minimum echo and a machine with internet, and you're done. You're ready.
Yeah. I'm not complaining.
The first time I really realized how large the internet was going to be, or was at the time, was by perusing through Yahoo. Yahoo, of course, gave you a manually edited cataloging system of the internet. And so you could find web pages by just stepping through it. And though I'd been using the web for a while before I knew about Yahoo even existed, when I went there and started seeing the expanse and the growth, how quickly it was added to, I was pretty darn impressed.
What? You had to wait until the World Wide Web before you thought the internet was going to be big?
I was on BBS's, man, and emailing people's.
No, I was thinking Usenet, actually.
That's what I meant. I meant Usenet. Sorry. Because a BBS wouldn't be the internet.
Gotcha. You got me?
You got a Yahoo story for us, sir?
Está muerto Yahoo.
Temporarily, then?
No, Yahoo is dead. As mentioned, the buyout by Verizon is going through. They're getting a name change to Altaba. CEO Marissa Mayer has quit the board, so she's parting
ways. Why are they getting rid of the Yahoo brand for a generic brand?
I would actually think that the Yahoo brand is pretty tainted at this point. It doesn't have any real brand loyalty, and it has been associated with a lot of very public security breaches and a sign of, you know, ongoing irrelevance. You know, back in 1995, you had a whole bunch of links on the Yahoo page, and people went to the Yahoo.com homepage as their homepage.
A lot of people are still using it for sports. Yahoo Sports is still
there. Their news is still there, but that may just be folded under Altaba. No one goes to Yahoo Sports because chances are you do a Google search and it takes you to Yahoo Sports or Yahoo Finance or something like that.
I think there's actually a lot of people that still have Yahoo as their homepage. But is Altaba is what you're saying?
Altaba.
Is that a popular brand somewhere? Because I've never heard of it.
I have never heard of it either. I think it's more along the lines of clean slate. Verizon has been balking for quite a while with regard to the sale because of all the problems with Yahoo.
Well, things like all these security breaches have slowly been kind of going, this was a problem.
Right. And also all of the infrastructure that Yahoo has, maybe they also don't want to have those products. So if you make a clean slate, you're no longer...
So what are you buying then when you buy Yahoo? You're buying all those products and its name.
You're buying patents, you're buying technologies, you're buying all of the stuff that's been there already. You're buying maybe some of the expertise to be able to purchase some of the more longer-lived employees, longer-term employees that have institutional knowledge. They do work in machine learning and stuff like that, like most large tech companies do these days.
I'm assuming you read up on this article a bit. Did they, when she stepped down from the board?
This is quick blurb. This was just announced today.
So it's relatively new.
Yeah.
So she stepped down, Mayer stepped down, and which means I guess the board is still in a functional piece rather than being totally sucked into the larger Verizon board.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been announced.
Right. Right.
That so the plan sale's gone through forward, and that Yahoo will be effectively dismantled.
Yeah. I bet its stock is not doing so well.
Or maybe I don't know. Being purchased by Verizon, that's one of the things that people have been talking about is, you know, they're seeing if the Verizon purchase would go through. Who knows? We'll see.
Let's look up the Yahoo stock real quick. After hours, it peaked a bit, and then it's kind of basically where it closed. I'm assuming that they closed today, and they made the announcement after close.
If Verizon didn't purchase them... Yahoo, what would Yahoo do? I mean, they were hemorrhaging money. They had nowhere to go.
They're going to be purchased by somebody. Yeah, makes sense. All right, thanks. I guess I was trying to bring back my warmth for Yahoo by starting that story because I do have a bit of a soft spot. A few years ago, I was running the JavaScript conference, the JSEver conference that you and I both spoke at one year and then I ran the next year. And I got a Yahoo person to come and speak at the conference. And actually, Yahoo threw some money down to help the conference out, which is kind of cool. And I was telling him that I think developers still, especially web developers, still have some kind of warmth for Yahoo. Do you feel that way?
I guess I just never had that warmth for Yahoo in the first place. It was never... I never really went to the registry to find an item. It just wasn't the way I ever used the web. Yeah. I was on the internet before the web came to be. So it was the web was just another mechanism. It wasn't the end all be all for how to find stuff. I already was in my patterns before that.
You already had
your
news group set up.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was a different experience for me than for many others.
Miles, I don't think we talk enough about bullets on this show.
The U.S. military is looking for bullets that biodegrade, that sprout plants, that animal life can eat after the fact and not get sick. The idea being
why?
That because that's a major problem in a lot of war zones is that you fire bullets and they pollute the soil, contaminate the soil with heavy metals or the like, that
right.
when animals will eat them, that they'll get sick.
Okay,
it messes up the ecosystem after the fact. Not as badly as the war does.
but that's true. I mean, when you're dealing with heavy armor, you want extremely dense material, and that's why you use depleted uranium rounds. It's extremely dense.
Well, that's a
metal.
Specific thing where you want to have a depleted uranium round to take out like tank armor. We're talking about bullets. You fire a rifle,
normally copper around lead or just lead itself. And of course, not so great for the environment. In fact, in some areas, what you can hunt with and what you can't hunt with depends on the kind of shot you're using. So in California, there's laws against using buckshot made of lead, for example.
And this is just the DOD looking at ways to do anything about it. I have to admit, I'm quite a bit skeptical just because if you're at war, chances are you want to use a thing that is most lethally effective rather than the other consideration that they can find something that would work about as well, they might do it. But if there's any drop off, you're going to see a lot of resistance from the people who are actually on the ground.
And that's actually why I was talking about depleted uranium and lead. The reason why those are used is they're extremely dense. And even though, I think gold is denser than lead, you don't use that because it's too expensive. Like there's a cost analysis, of course, and there's a effectiveness. And both those things are extremely important. I don't see when war is being done, the decades later environment being really looked at. Then again, we are very careful with mine planting. If we even do that anymore, we do mine maps so we can take them out afterwards. So there is some things we've done, we've learned over time that you can devastate an environment for a long period of time because of war. And so this is just probably one of those things similar to making sure you pick up all your unexploded mines if you lay landmines.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
But at the same time, it's... Depleted uranium is an interesting thing just because on its own, while it's not great to eat, the real danger of it is when it hits a heavy piece of armor and pulverizes, aerosolizes.
Sure.
And then you breathe it.
Right.
Because
but what could be biodegradable?
It's actually fairly stable and it's not that radioactive. That's why it's called depleted uranium.
Yeah,
it's that
uranium-238
just you can't be used for other means. That's the whole point behind it being used in munitions.
It's interesting the fear that people have about lead because of childhood lead poisoning,
mm-hmm.
and specifically about flakes and dust of lead from paint as it degrades. Thank you. And now there's a D in there. And how that
if it comes out of a tailpipe.
Right. So basically, if you get it in your body, it's very hard for your body to get rid of it, and the side effects of brain development.
Right. They do. There is some thought process that. Remember the whole big hype in the 90s about the super predator? They were worried about there are various theories as to why the 90s didn't end up being a Mad Max apocalyptic wasteland of violence. One of them being that we phased out lead, especially leaded gasoline in the early 70s, or rather that started in that realm. And so we were alive when there was still leaded gasoline being sold, but it phased out within the first 6 years of our life, something
yes,
like
that.
And those cars just ended up going off the road.
What is the apocalyptic society? How does that fall into that?
Well, if you take the lead away, then one of the side effects of lead is cognition issues, learning disabilities, and increased violence.
Increased violence comes from lead
poisoning? Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know about that. Interesting.
Yeah. Propensity towards violence and not being able to moderate your reactions.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the other aspect of this, though, is lead by itself, like picking up a piece of lead and holding it in your hand and putting it down, assuming you're not doing that every day and licking your fingers, is not actually dangerous per se.
Even looking actually wouldn't be as bad. It's the whole breathe. It's the breathing. It's the, so you have particles embedding in your lungs to slowly emit.
So I talk to people about painting lead figures because, of course, growing up as a D&D nerd, I did a lot of lead figure painting. And now my son is doing it. And we're in his room right now and I see that he's got a big tray of paints behind him that are not lead paints, but he paints lead. But when I mention that to people that don't know what I mean when I say paint lead, they're like, what? You let your kid play with lead? Like, yeah, but, you know, he's older and he's not eating it anymore. And
anymore.
Additionally, most lead you actually buy now is it's a mix and it's not actually pure lead.
It does make me wonder, though, what alternate, you know, counterfactuals, what would we be like if lead had never been introduced as an additive into gasoline?
How would our society be different?
Would society look different, or would it look substantially similar?
Okay, so how would you classify the generation that has grown up after us? The kids, the people that were kids when we were teenagers, they never had lead in their environment like we did. Even, you know, we have, of course, had it even the first 6 years of our lives. That's still pretty effective. Are those people less violent or more intelligent than us?
We got rid of we saw the end of lead. They saw the beginning of Adderall. So it's kind of a
what happened is that
you know, we got rid of lead, they got meth. So we'll see how that works, how that plays out over the long term.
Yeah, but that's not in the environment. People had to take it. And what percentage of kids actually took Adderall?
In colleges?
Yeah.
It's quite prevalent.
Wow, it's kind of intense.
Especially because people don't think about the fact that it's chemically quite close to just being methamphetamine. Like, that's why it works so well. That's why people are like, yeah, I can stay up and study and I get it all.
How are people getting – are people getting that legally or not legally?
No, you would need a prescription for it, and no, people aren't getting it legally. But when was the last time you knew college students to worry about the legality of the substances that they were taking? That's kind of the story behind college, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's what you learn there, right?
Yeah, whereas it used to be the stuff that wouldn't necessarily help you study.
Uber seems to always be doing something that seems a little nasty to me. For example, their take on, well, yeah, we're going to have autonomous cars, and we're hoping to get rid of all our drivers. Even though their entire company is built up by all these independent contractors that drive for them. It's kind of a slap in the face.
Independent contractors / employees, and we're not really sure whichever way is most beneficial to the Uber bottom line rather than the public. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Uber is doing something that's trying to appease government, I guess.
Or who knows their rationale for it. They may be doing it just because they don't have any good use for the data. But they are giving cities free travel time data. In other words, taking all of the information being gathered from the Uber app by other drivers and presumably by passengers as well. As they go through a city and you're able to see choke points in traffic. In real time by a non-trivial number of vehicles.
Google would have this data too, wouldn't they?
With Waze and stuff like that when they're doing turn-by-turn directions, yes. But at the same time, I don't know how much Google is sharing this information. The difference here is that Uber is giving this information away for free to the municipalities that they're in. It could very well be a carrot to try to sweeten the pot so that they can improve their PR image. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when you have behemoths like Google out there with their maps technology and the amount of aggregate data that they have, it may be that Uber just doesn't see the same profit potential for that data. Why not release it?
They can't necessarily profit easily from it because like Google has so much better data on traffic flow because more people have Google apps installed on their phone than Uber drivers are out on the street. So that kind of makes sense. But the appeasement aspect – well, so the other aspect, though, of course, is that maybe they're also planning on selling this data, right? So they start giving it to cities, and the cities, of course, with restriction to say, you know, you can use this for infrastructure planning and for other things you might want to do to run your city. But if another company wants to use it to better plan their routes, they might have to buy it from Uber. So like somebody like UPS using it might mean they have to actually pay Uber for the cost. So if they create a market to some level, it gives more value to the data itself.
Sure. I could buy that. At the same time, this is all supposition. Don't know.
It also potentially improves Uber's future business, right? Assuming that Uber stays around and becomes the de facto automated cab company that they probably will become, having a city doing things that benefit their flow of traffic benefits Uber as well. So, okay. This is a great story. I'm so happy to hear that there's actually an arrest in this case. Tell me what's going on with Volkswagen.
Well, back in the day, and by back in the day, I mean 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, Volkswagen was caught in what is being referred to as Dieselgate. I don't much care for that. It just means they were cheating on their emissions,
right.
Which is interesting to me because I know people who have purchased it, the Sportwagen diesel. It was on my short list. It was either going to be the Honda minivan that I got or that vehicle.
Well, it had great mileage.
Yeah, that was the idea. It was getting like 40 miles to the gallon with just diesel, just a simple diesel engine. Or, I mean, not simple, but I mean, not having the complexity of a hybrid, not having the, and still having the range that you don't have with an electric. But then it came out that, no, they were cheating. And for a long time, you had executives saying, like, oh, we didn't know about that. It was a mistake, or it was some manager on a lower level.
And we always kind of knew that that was bull, right?
Right. Well, it turns out that they got a memo that was talking about how the executives were briefed on it and then not just knew about it, but then said, oh, this had been a secret and someone had done this. Well, we don't want to actually release that we know about it, and we want you to keep doing it.
It's interesting.
So, I mean, it was like the worst possible scenario. Right.
You could see them going, we have to divulge this immediately. Or you could see them saying, don't divulge it and stop it.
Right.
Right. So, either of those things would be the right thing to do.
So the executive, Oliver Schmidt, was arrested by the FBI over the weekend on charges of conspiracy to defraud.
The FBI? So he was in the U.S.? Or...
That's a good question. You know, I assume so.
Car companies are so big that it's, as far as all I know, Volkswagen headquarters could be in the U.S. You know, who knows how international corporations
work. Yeah, there is a U.S. branch of it. At the same time, I know of cases where the FBI has, with the country's permission, gone in and arrested someone because they have claimed jurisdiction.
Sure.
And because it does cross state lines, it is federal jurisdiction rather than just general police.
I don't even know if they were the vehicles they were selling in Europe, in Germany, for example, their assumed headquarters. They might not have been doing this rule because, of course, what they were doing is fighting U.S. emission laws. I don't know what the emission laws are there. Well, I'm assuming they're just as tight, if not tighter, than
what the EU has actually found recently. I don't have the article in front of me, but something I read a while back was emissions from diesel vehicles is higher than what was originally stated in Europe. And so a lot of the reasoning behind having diesels, that extra gas efficiency in exchange for extra emissions, the extra emissions was actually too conservative an estimate. They are actually much higher.
Oh,
and so you're seeing some places in Europe talk about, for example, in Paris, I know they were talking about making it a no internal combustion engine city,
mm-hmm.
that only electric vehicles would be allowed. And there have been other cities that have been proposing, you know, the same thing.
It makes sense at a large level because, of course, the city infrastructure itself, you want to minimize the amount of vehicles on the street.
Assuming that you have a working public transit infrastructure.
Yes, and that's the other benefit is that normally they do have them. Additionally, you have to have electric charging infrastructure, right? You can't say all cars in New York City are now electric without putting a giant electric grid that can charge all those vehicles.
Mm-hmm. VW has been making some pushes for redoing, like, so a software update to get rid of that difference, and also some hardware updates, which is putting in a urea receptacle, which is what's required for doing the equivalent of a catalytic converter for a diesel engine to get rid of those nitrous oxide emissions. The problem is that it has weight, it has mass, it requires that you go in and refill it on a regular basis as well. It's another thing to watch out
additionally,
for.
Additionally, doesn't it waste some of the energy, if you will, converting that?
It does. So efficiency will go, or at least mileage may go down slightly.
Well, I mean,
it's actually not that bad. It's just that with big commercial trucks, if you add a little extra weight, it's not that big of a deal because they're hauling massive amounts of weight. The extra weight that you add in there is not a large percentage of the total mass that you're having to move around.
Are you
passenger
saying
cars,
actually,
that's a little different.
So you're saying it's not a catalyst, it's actually a consumable, the urea?
It's both.
Okay.
It's not partial something that you can just leave.
Catalytic and also consumable.
Right. It is catalytic, but it's used up in that conversion.
Right. So one of the things that's really interesting to hear you say this, and I kind of finally was getting one of these pieces that I think is a little tricky for people to understand. The vehicle, the VW, when it was cheating on its emissions, did have better gas mileage. It just was a larger pollutant. So when you decrease pollutant, you decrease efficiency, and you decrease therefore gas mileage.
One of the ways that you with any engine,
yeah,
that even a gasoline engine, that you can increase mileage. We already know how to make gas engines, straight gasoline engines, 87 octane, you know, go better, which is you run them hotter so that you burn the fuel more completely.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is you run them much harder. You start having chemical reactions with the nitrogen, which is most of our atmosphere, in that combustion chamber.
Gotcha.
Which doesn't
happen as
much.
Other side-affected chemicals coming out.
Right. And the nitrous oxides are really bad. You don't want them going out there. So we force auto manufacturers to run at a lower compression temperature, so that the amount of nitrous oxides is reduced in exchange for lower efficiency and then having the catalytic converter clean up
the stuff. So what you're saying is that – so I just find it interesting because normally when you're comparing two vehicles, the gas mileage – is twofold for me. It's, of course, the cheaper amount, like the better gas mileage, the less I'm going to spend on gas. But the secondary aspect of it is I feel like if it's a better gas mileage vehicle, then I'm using less gas. I'm being less of a pollutant because my 4 miles use this much.
Yeah, you want to think that.
But in reality, interesting. Of course, I own an electric vehicle, which has a different side effects.
Which is interesting about hybrid vehicles, like when the Toyota
like
Prius...
Yours.
When it first came out, people were like, oh, look, it's getting 50 miles a gallon. I was excited about 50 miles a gallon. It turns out that wasn't Toyota's goal. Toyota's goal was to reduce emissions. The mileage came along for the ride.
Right. Interesting.
I mean, Toyota was really ahead of the curve on that.
So speaking of electric vehicles.
And speaking of Volkswagen, Volkswagen has announced an electric bus. So think of the old Volkswagen bus that hippies still drive around in Santa Cruz.
Does it look the same?
It looks like a modernized version of the old bus. And some people have likened it to looking like the Scooby-Doo van, the Mystery Machine.
Oh, it looks pretty cool.
It has the general shape of a Volkswagen bus, only it's more streamlined and it has more modern features to it. You don't have the grill up in front. That prominent grill.
Well, it's electric, so. But also, right. Wait, why did it have a grill up front? Isn't the motor in the back of? I mean, I know the motor is the back of the VW bus. So, what was the grill for?
I think it was aesthetics.
Wow. Wait, did it have a big grill? Didn't have a big grill.
It didn't.
It had vents.
Oh, that's right. That's right. It was that
in the back
piece.
Were side vents. Okay.
Well, let's put it this way: this one doesn't have any creases.
This also, we're looking at a 3D rendering, and if you've got a really awesome podcast feed, you can see it in your podcast feed right now. But I mean, awesome podcast player, you can see an image of this VW bus. But this is clearly a rendering, and it's also looks like a concept car. It's one of those things you can tell from tires when there's concept cars because they always make the tires pretty. But in reality, they're going to put a tire on there you can buy. And so it's going to be rubber and it's going to have a standard size, you know, everything.
But they are talking about, just like with most vehicles, I think, coming in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
A self-driving mode of some sort. This one is like a limited self-driving mode.
That makes sense. So they're saying electric and they're also saying, when are they going to start selling them?
They are talking about 2020, I believe.
Yeah. As they say, in 2025, VW...
2025, okay.
No, 2025, VW plans to be selling 1 million electric vehicles annually. So I don't know when this vehicle is actually going to hit the shelves. But first off, in the U.S., electric van or electric minivan, this is clearly the size of a minivan. This is not like a giant van. It just looks more like
right,
a van.
Right, it's the minibus.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like probably the same size as our vans. But in any case, there aren't electric vans right now minivans. Are there?
Right. There's one hybrid minivan that was announced recently that we covered on the show.
Yeah, sure.
Which I thought was, like I said, I thought was an excellent idea. That of all the cars, it should be a hybrid. It seems like something like a minivan should be at the top of the list. But
yeah.
One of the issues, though, which I'm sure you can tell me, like what is the biggest thing that you would want to have changed in your electric car? You have a Nissan Leaf.
In my Leaf?
Yeah.
I want more battery duration or faster charging or both, please.
Okay. So it's not about your visibility in the car, how it handles.
No, that vehicle's great. It handles well. It's up, you know, it's speedy. Feels good when I drive it. It's got, I mean, first off, I got the top end model, so it's got leather seats and heat warmers. In California, we don't have a lot of warm seats in cars because we just don't have a lot of temperature like that. So this is the first I've had of that nature. It's also the first non-manual transmission I've had. It's automatically obviously an automatic. In fact, there isn't no transmission. It's just straight drive, right? Maybe there's some gear ratio, but basically it never shifts.
Most of the time with electric vehicles, they don't have a gear ratio. They just run the motor.
Just run the motor and hit the wheels and you're done. The other thing that's great about it, because I've got the cameras all around, is extremely easy to navigate. So whenever I go out and drive around and look for houses or kind of explore the mountains that we live in, it's so much fun because I can turn around basically in the same size as the vehicle knowing I'm not going to hit anything because I've got cameras at all angles and everything. Anyway, so yeah, the vehicle's great. However, I, you know, drove to the airport this morning and then went to work. And if I couldn't have charged at work, I would barely be making it home. And that's a problem.
So about a 75-mile range?
It says 100 when I'm leaving home. I think I've never pushed it.
But you have to go up over 17. So.
Yeah. When you lose a lot. If you flat, yeah, 100. But yeah, up and down, I would say 75, yeah.
And a tailwind, you get 120.
Exactly. And free fall, it's amazing.
Well, Samsung is working on making that better, with some other...
Samsung is making batteries?
Yep.
Didn't their last thing have, like, batteries exploding?
Well, that's because their phone didn't leave any space for the battery to expand. So hopefully they'll be leaving some space for the battery to expand within the vehicle. But they're talking about having a battery that gets 300 or more miles of range after a 20-minute charge.
What?
So a maximum range of about what they say 372 miles. But as the case with many rechargeable batteries, you can charge up to, you know, 80 or 90% very quickly. That last little bit needs to be pushed
sure.
very carefully.
Yeah.
And so you can get to 310 miles or so with just 20 minutes. And then the rest of it, you'd have to trickle charge. But you'd think with that type of thing where you go like, oh, 20 minutes, plug it in and then go. I mean, you leave your car parked or charging overnight, right?
Here at the house, yeah, because I don't have like a high current charging station.
So for a lot of folks, that may also be the case.
Yeah.
But it would be convenient to do.
If you could do that in 20 minutes, that means you can travel any distance, right? Because you can stop. Take a bathroom break, you know, I mean, you do take a bathroom break and take a walk with your dog and then, wow, you can get back in the car and drive another 3 miles.
Or stop at the local In-N-Out, you know.
Yeah. Is that the one you eat at?
Yeah. It's a guilty pleasure. It's just whenever I go on a road trip.
I almost did an In-N-Out burger every day this year because the first 6 days of this year I happened to have In-N-Out every day. Sometimes more than once.
So is that
I was traveling?
Is that why your girth is a...
And actually, I've been losing weight, too. But that's because I cut out sugar.
I do, too, by the way. But we'll talk about some other time.
The thing that's creepy about In-N-Out burgers, though, is that they're all... The facilities are all the same. So you can be in one, and you're like, was I in this one already? And when you add sleep deprivation and, like, a family member that's losing their memory and having to ask questions repetitively. And that's what you do. So that's what I did is I moved Maggie's mom into a facility because mm-hmm. she's having dementia. And so of course what we're doing is long days of moving and cleaning and figuring out stuff and trying to get refrigerators sold on Craigslist, driving long distances, and then having conversations with her, repetitive conversations, as you know, from your father's illness. And what happens when you engage with that long enough, you start questioning your own reality at some level, you know, because they have their own perspective in life. And normally, you know, humans are very social.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. How often have you worked in a technical environment where the people start reacting to you much like a logical engine? They're saying, well, there's this. That's not true. Got to do the very point of fact. People, I'm sure, have come across this if they have an engineer friend of theirs. And then you have people who are kindergarten teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up talking to other people, to adults, like they talk to their kids. This very non-confrontational, very supportive, nurturing voice.
Right.
And you know, and you hear it and you recognize it. And the same thing happens with regard to talking with dementia, as you were saying. That's something that people don't really talk about so much. And I wish people did, because if I had known that it was a common occurrence, it would have been so much easier.
Do you mean that you started speaking like a dementia patient?
No,
or?
I mean that I started doubting my wits.
Yes.
And any mistake you have, you start to worry like, oh my God, is this happening to me?
Right.
And you get stressed out caring for someone suffering from it. And people will notice like you're being a little off as well,
because right.
you're trying to not lose your patience, because you know it's not – but at the same time, it's an intensely frustrating experience for everyone involved.
And of course, the entire time you are thinking about thought. You're thinking about how we have memories and how we form our ideas. That's what's happening, because you're trying to figure out how to communicate to this person that's thinking differently than you.
Right.
And so pretty soon you're in the space where you're analyzing yourself about what you're doing. You're not getting enough sleep because you're taking care of somebody else, which is difficult. Having the whole problem of taking away somebody else's liberty is extremely painful, because, of course, in this society, we're used to giving everybody liberty, and evil people take
away
liberty.
Wait, how do we get onto this topic?
In an outburger, man. So I'm doing all this driving and all this stuff, late hours, and talking with someone who has dementia and trying to like answer a question over and over, the same question over and mm-hmm. over again, and then going into an In-N-Out burger, and I'm like, wait, did I have a burger today? Is this the same store I was in before? What town am I in? Because there was two In-N-Out yep. burgers, and they're about 35 minutes away from each other, and I went into each of them, and they were exactly the same, mm-hmm. but a different staff and different time of day. Was it light outside?
Same biblical quote on the bottom of the cup. Yeah.
Is there a biblical quote in the bottom of the cup?
Yeah.
What does it say?
I've forgotten which one it is, but I've always admired them. Like, they're very religious, and at the same time, they're not proselytizing. It's just
except for the bottom of their cup.
Well, I mean, it's not in your face, and it's just they're an expression of faith without being confrontational about it. It's awesome.
I had this. My wife's going through some dietary changes, really restrictive diet, and so we were going through, and I was eating burgers, and we were making food for her. So we were also making an extra meal and all that.
The road trip edition of Geek Speak is now being talked
about. Exactly. And so we go in there, and I said, oh, you could get some. She's like, I can't eat anything here. I was like, you get some lettuce and some grilled onions. And she's like, they probably grill the onions with something I can't eat. So I go up, and I'm like, what do you grill your onions with? Like, he goes, what? I'm like,
wait, why would you do that? Caramelized onions, they taste really sweet without doing anything to them.
Well, because you kind of have to oil the pan. So I want to know if he was using butter to oil the pan or using olive oil, vegetable oil. I want to know what kind of oil.
Oh, okay.
He goes, we don't use any oil. I'm like, you don't? He's like, no. We just cook it on the pan. I mean, on the surface, and just turn it over, and that's it. I'm like, thanks. He's like, do you want to try some? I'm like, oh, yeah, it'd be great. So he gives me – I was like, yeah, let me have a side. And he goes, okay. And he gives me a side. And so I'm like trying to pay him. He's like, are you going to order something? I'm like, no, I just want to try these. And he's like, okay, great, thanks. Didn't charge me for them. He was curious like I was curious, and it was easy. Anyway, yeah, nice business. As fast foods go that sell beef, I mean, depending on your perspective, they're evildoers. All right. Well, that's cool. The thing about discussions about batteries, this is how we got into this, by the way, is talking about batteries.
Yes, yes, yes.
Everybody says they've made a breakthrough in batteries, and the batteries can be so much better. And we all know that batteries are like the limiting factor on almost every cool thing you can possibly imagine. You could even say that we could all have jetpacks if only we had most efficient batteries possible, right? It's about power portability mm-hmm. and usage. And we've covered over the years of Geek Speak so many stories about batteries being better.
Mm-hmm.
And I still buy Duracell AA's in my home, and they still are the most expensive type of energy you can possibly
yes,
buy.
But you also had your company buy a very expensive phone that is slimmer
yeah.
and smaller in many ways in terms of the battery capacity than just about anything you've ever had before. But the density is so high that it can, and the efficiency of the rest of the phone, but the density is so high that it compensates for it.
Right.
So the battery density of the original iPhone is much, much lower than the current iPhone 7, for example. So there have been some tremendous increases in efficiency. It's just that they haven't translated to manufacturers understanding that they should build larger batteries so that we don't have to charge them midway through the day.
What you're saying is you're done with the slimming. You want the power at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally get that. Speaking of which, I've got a little video up on YouTube about batteries, about the 18650 and what its size is and such, and also about the little cell batteries that you put in your car.
The 18650.
It's a lithium-ion battery, or it can be a lithium-ion battery, and it looks like a large AA, longer and wider.
Got it. Okay.
This is the actual core of almost all portable devices. So if you've got a camera at home that you pull out your battery pack, there's like, it looks like it's got two bumps on it and it's flat on the back, and it's about, you know, I don't know, the size of a half a play card, playing cards, but thicker. Inside there is this battery. This battery is kind of like universally everywhere. And its size is actually has to do with its measurements. So you can measure it in millimeters, and that's why
the size is. Much the same as the coin batteries.
And the coin batteries the same way. So that's what my little video is about, is kind of talking about what those are. In any case, I'll link that to the show. And it's true that those batteries did not exist in as much when we started GeekSpeak, right? Whether they existed or not at that point. But they now are everywhere, and you can buy a lot of stuff, especially through...
Yeah, I still remember when I was a teenager playing with radio-controlled cars.
Yeah.
It's like, all I know about cars is basically from radio-controlled cars. It's kind of sad, my automotive ability, but I still know enough now, like, what a differential is, how it's put together, at least a ball-bearing differential in the case of my RC10.
Is that why your car is always fixed with rubber cement glue? Yeah, no?
And things like camber and toe-in. The reason I know those is because I would play around with an RC card and rebuild
it. What's camber and toe-in?
Camber is where the wheels are vertically, how
not
vertical
parallel.
They are.
Okay.
Yeah, so whether they're, you know, off vertical or not, in or out, usually camber is going to be in.
The top is in, it's splayed?
Yes.
The wheels are splayed?
Yeah. And the gives more stability in that case, but it slows you down sometimes.
Sure.
Then there's toe-in for a rear wheel drive vehicle. Having that toe-in would allow you to get better traction.
Toe-in means that the back of the wheels are closer together than the front of the wheels, parallel to the ground, if you will, the angle. Okay.
Yeah, I'm making these gestures with my hands, and Lyle's realizing that no one can see what I'm doing. And you see, like, the pros and cons for it, and I had learned all this stuff about how on this type of track you don't want to have it, but on this type of track you want to dial it in more. And one of the things about these cars is you would charge them on a quick charger for 15 minutes, these nickel-cadmium batteries.
Right.
And then you'd ride them for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then the batteries would run out, and you're like, so you needed to have, you know, three battery packs if you wanted to continuously go. You'd run one down and then put on a quick charger
and the same thing with the lithium ion batteries. If you're using those as your car batteries now, they're just a lot lighter. Well, they charge faster, I guess, comparatively to rundown speed.
Yeah, and you can get ones that last longer than 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah. But can you get them long? Can you get them that they will charge faster than they deplete? I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
But see, I mean,
okay,
like,
they
went from nickel cadmium to nickel metal hydride.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of missed that transition because I was, nickel metal hydride was just coming out just as I was no longer playing with my RC car anymore.
You got interested in ladies, huh? Or computers.
Mm-hmm.
Probably computers.
Less free time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Had to get into college. At any rate, so nickel metal hydride, like, gave a nice bump. But now when you get into the lithium ion, that is hugely better than nickel cadmium.
Yeah, definitely.
Not to mention less toxic.
Except for when they explode.
Well,
catch on fire.
Yeah, in general, they don't. But
unless you charge them wrong. We have a larger, I guess a larger topic. I don't know if it's a larger topic, but about clean energy and how we're moving towards that. Let's talk about that for a while.
Yeah, we have a sitting president who published an article in Science Magazine.
Yeah?
Yeah. Talking about his views on clean energy. So it isn't something like former Energy Secretary Chu doing a physics paper, you know, out there. But he was talking about, and I thought it was an interesting read anyway, talking about how clean energy is not a partisan issue.
Yeah.
And that it, or rather, it is a partisan issue, but it doesn't matter, I guess is the way to describe it.
What do you mean it doesn't matter?
Because the economics of doing things more efficiently and a lot of the clean tech that's coming out, the improvements in battery technology, the moving toward the ability to make things run more efficiently is just makes business sense. Like it doesn't matter that it's kind of a – people regard it as a hippy-dippy thing. It's because it's cheaper and more efficient – it would be foolish to go back to other means. Like, for example, solar power is now reaching that tipping point of being cheaper per unit of energy than coal. So why would you go back to coal if the solar panels that are coming out are going to give you a better return on investment?
And we know that this is an inevitable process because I remember years ago the argument about getting away from fossil fuels and that someday we'll have to go to another source of energy. One of the ways of making that argument is, okay, let's assume that the Earth is completely full of petrol. Like 100%, it's just a ball of petrol. There's nothing else there. So let's not talk about, no, we'll find more. I'm talking about like it's full of petrol. It's completely one sphere of petrol. Now, we start using it at this ratio and we grow at this rate. We will be done with oil at this period of time. So we know it's sooner than that, right? So we still have a problem at that point. The whole point of it was, it's not about whether we can find more. It's at one point, it will be inefficient to try to find more. Like,
yeah.
And we're basically getting potentially close to that. Though I have to say,
well, it is very inefficient. That's why we have deep horizon. You know,
we have not complicated
the problems
systems
with that, but the fact that we dug so deeply for that.
One of the actual downsides actually of fracking is that it was so successful and that it allowed oil to drop in price and allowed economic shifting to happen because all of a sudden...
And ground shifting in Oklahoma.
Ground shifting as well, unfortunately. Not to mention the bad qualities of it. It has done a boon to the petrol industry in the United States. And that's problematic because, of course, that competes with the other green energy sources if petrol becomes cheaper.
But it also competes with the other carbon sources.
True.
And that's where a lot of the offset has been coming from.
Right.
Not necessarily away from green tech, because green tech has still been growing like gangbusters, but coal has taken a major hit.
Right. And so coal now is – yeah, in any case. Additionally, it's been economic across governmental lines. Rather, the United States has won a lot in the fracking industry, and other countries have not. So our trade switch has happened in oil. But let's not get into that because neither of us are experts in that economic boon. But in general, this article by Barack Obama looks actually pretty technical and gets into some details about the economics of the situation.
Right.
Talks about
the private sector, the amount of emissions that are being reduced. Like I said, in the case of efficiency and convenience. But thinking about all of the other effects, like if you go to clean tech, you don't have as many pollutants, so many particulates in the air, which means that people's health improves in an area as well.
Especially in cities.
Right. I think of the photos that I see from New York City in the 70s.
Bad.
Before the EPA. And I think of my own memories of the very late 70s, early 80s in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to see the Hollywood Hills, not being able to see the Hollywood sign for a while.
And here as well, driving to Silicon Valley as a kid, I remember it being like that.
Yeah, because it was quite brown. And I remember looking when I was 13 years old, just before the moving away from Inglewood, the same locations that I was in, looking and seeing the Hollywood sign and seeing those mountains out there where I had never I remembered not being able to see them. I remember the brown haze.
Right, only after a rain, which of course happens once every 4 years in Los Angeles. Totally. The rules and regulations definitely have shifted and cleaned the air so far. And you're right that green. So what he's basically saying is the economic side effect of doing more green energies, if you will, non-pollutant energies. Mm-hmm. Allows for better, healthier people as well as potentially other benefits
right.
to economy.
And we're seeing some of this in China as well. Right now, they're having huge problems with air pollution because there is no regulation and there is a huge amount of disease associated with that. But China is also extremely bullish, at least from the government point of view, and they push a lot of the agenda, economic agenda, is trying to clean that up. And there's a big push by the citizens of China to say, like, this needs to be cleaned up. This, you know, having to wear a mask every day is oppressive.
Yeah. You know, one of the little article, one of the paragraph snippets that I'm going to read this and talk a little bit about it. And that is, this is from the article in sciencemag.org by Barack Obama. Estimates of the economic damages from warming of 4 degrees C over pre-industrial levels ranging from 1 to 5% of global GDP each year by 2100. He cites an article. You can read more about this. One of the most frequent cited economic models pins this estimate of annual damages from warming of 4 degrees C at roughly 4% of global GDP, which could lead to lost U.S. federal revenue of roughly $340 billion to $690 billion annually. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, I'm not clicking on these to read these links. There's like three different links backing up that data. Mm-hmm. What is it that causes an increase in global temperatures to be detrimental to human economy?
One, you end up with you have acidification of the oceans. More CO2 dissolves into
in the oceans and making it more acidic.
Yes.
Which does what?
Which has an effect upon the wildlife within the oceans.
Okay.
So you're reducing catches there.
Okay.
You have to put an infrastructure around coastal cities to keep the ocean from inundating them, especially in hurricane-prone areas.
So there's a giant investment in infrastructure for protecting waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You sprung this on me.
This on you. It's not really fair to spring on you, but it's one of those things that, you know, I hear from my Santa Cruz isolated area, mm-hmm. a lot of people are like, no, you can't do that. It's so horrible. And of course, some other negatives that we know about, it totally changes the way environments are and will kill off species that exist in certain areas.
Here was the other one.
The economic thing, I don't hear a lot of talk about.
It affects rainfall patterns. Mm-hmm, so there are a lot of the areas that used to have rainfall would end up in a drought situation. Other places that had different rainfall patterns may get inundated.
Right.
Because global climate change is not just about a uniform warming.
Right.
It's about a disruption of
that climate. In a naive thought, you could say, well, the general temperature, the average temperatures will get hotter at the equator and all the way up, and therefore the climate environments that are there will just slightly move up the, north and more south, right? And that's actually not what's really going to happen, right? So we have like Death Valley, for example, which is in Southern California, mm-hmm. and Nevada, right? It's Death Valley in Southern California, Nevada. But anyway, deserts in the Southern California and in Nevada, which you don't grow with, you don't have a lot of water, potentially could get the kind of water level that Central Valley of California gets, and Central Valley of California could shift so that it didn't get that much water. So that kind of drastic change could occur. And then you're in a situation where you don't actually have the soil in the desert environments because you haven't had years and years of organisms making a complex.
Well, that's a big shift because to get the water to the deserts, many times you have to go over mountain ranges.
Right.
That's where a lot of the water gets dumped. So you may end up with areas like Ben Lomond, which are on the coast, and you
get tons of water here.
Get tons of water that you may get inundated where other places get more and more parched.
I see. Okay.
Like I said, it's not quite clear
how
it'll turn out. So crop yields, we have crops that are expecting a certain area may not work anymore. There are some crops that require a certain number of days of frost that you wouldn't have that frost
anymore.
So
you might lose those crops, for example.
Well, at least they wouldn't fruit.
You wouldn't be able to eat persimmons anymore, for example. So I guess what I'm saying is these are all scary, potentially catastrophic, potentially not. But whether it affects how it affects our economy is very hard to say. For example, you take a Soviet Union. All of a sudden, the Soviet Union has a lot more warmth. Soviet Union being warmer might be produce more crops. I don't know what's going to happen. But the thing is,
they have permafrost that is releasing methane. And so that's causing a forcing effect, which is making the problem even worse because methane is a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2 is.
So let's say the temperature of the Soviet Union average temperature raises 7 or 8 degrees. Couldn't that potentially be beneficial to the Soviet Union?
It's really hard to point to a specific thing because you also have these areas that are mostly permafrost. What is the effect upon an area that is no longer has a permafrost? In other words, a permanently frozen layer.
I totally get what you're saying is, well, we don't know what's going to happen here. It might change there. All these are a lot of what-ifs and what-ifs.
The U.S. is a lot easier to deal with.
But how is it that you then take all these lots of catastrophic, horrible things will happen and turn that into a financial amount of $340 billion to $690 billion annually. How do you translate all these unknowns into some kind of figure? I guess you got
to
read these papers.
Well, you do look at, for example, climate models. You look to see which ones have historically been the most accurate. Mm-hmm. And you look at their predictions for the rate and intensity of hurricanes, for example. You already know what the average cost to a hurricane would be. So then you calculate what is going to be the effect of larger and more frequent hurricanes, and you tally out those numbers.
And you
there's
get
something that you can get an actuarial number off of. When you look at the effect of droughts on a particular area, because droughts happen everywhere, and you see what that happens, then you look at the models and see how often the droughts and the length of the droughts for an area, you can then extrapolate.
Right.
So there is data.
So this is all kind of basing off of what we know about climate science, challenging at some level what the side effects will be of this kind of change.
Sure.
Because...
And that's why there's such a variance. They're saying between
right.
300 and 600 billion. That's quite a variance there.
Yeah, sure.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's a 50% variance.
Right. But at the same time, think of areas that are between 120 and 130 degrees Fahrenheit now, like the areas of the Middle East, like in Iran, places that have had record heat waves. Now imagine you go up another 10 or 15 degrees because, like I said, it's uneven. It's not just 4 degrees C in one area. So you're going to have these extremes at different places, extreme cold in one place, extreme heat in another. You're starting to talk about temperatures that are not habitable
right.
by human beings. Like I'm thinking of the Australian Western Desert, Central Western Desert, where just people don't live there. You
right.
have an occasional person every once in a while, but there are no settlements there. It's a whole lot of nothing.
Additionally, lots of parts of Canada and upper Russia is also the same way. No one lives there, right? Because the climate is so cold. So you could potentially just move the boundary up. I'm not saying that it's a good thing to do to do global warming. I just am always curious how we make an economic model.
Well, we'll have to make room papers. Because there are a lot of island nations that are going underneath the waves.
Sure.
And you have a lot of coastal cities that are going away. And you have a lot of areas in the tropics that are going to become a lot more hostile in terms of heat.
Well, if you're curious about the topic, feel free to read Barack Obama's article about it, where he's actually citing the models that he's referencing in the quote that I just read, and actually this goes on quite a bit. But yeah, there's more information there, and obviously I need to dive into this as well. Did you want to talk more about clean energy?
I think we beat this horse quite enough.
Yeah, as much as we can, since we don't know much about it. We do know a bit about APIs, because we're both developers, and an API is an application programming interface.
Right. It's you don't rewrite an entire program from scratch. You take existing building blocks and then stitch them together more often than not.
Yeah, it's very common now when talking about making an app for an iPhone app, for example. The first class you're going to do is kind of like get a whole bunch of tweets from Twitter and put them in a feed. And like you've got your data source, which is from Twitter, and it's just putting a whole bunch of tweets in just so you can learn how to program it.
Yeah. And then I read my configuration from the file system. So the operating system is providing this ability to be able to read from your SD card to then organize that data and then make it easily accessible through whatever interface you're doing
right.
or through whatever, like a browser or a native application, things like that. There's a whole lot of stuff that's done for you.
Yeah, I was talking about – and in speaking to Twitter, what you're doing is you're using their API, something they've defined and made public to you. And basically, they're the building blocks of all software development. In fact, we actually wouldn't – you and I have probably never written an application, even though we've been writing applications for years and systems for years, without using somebody else's API.
No, I've actually written assembly language before.
Oh, cool. What for? Printers?
No, was it for a class.
Okay, for a class.
Yeah.
Okay. In your professional life? I mean, yeah, I've done I've done step operators on an 8080 chip and like done.
I've looked at the assembly language stack that comes out, but no, I never.
I mean, in our professional lives,
there is
build off of platform stuff.
There is the stuff for like optimizations, but yeah, even
yeah, some of your code potentially, you're just using the bare language. You want to resort an array or something. You're doing
But it's been a really long time since I even looked at that, just because most of the performance problems.
In any high level language, even assembly. When you use
low-level language.
Any high-level language, oh, okay. And even assembly, a low level, you are using the language itself, and the language itself has complexity built into it, which is kind of an API. So when you say store this memory, when you say to the processor, do this, that's the API of the processor doing that, right? I mean, it's one way of thinking about it. I guess it's an application hardware interface.
Yeah, it's a hardware interface.
In any case, we're always building off building blocks.
Yes.
One of those examples is actually going away, which is kind of sad to me. You had this story about...
Well, this is another one of Google going, oh, we don't feel like doing it anymore, axe it. Google Hangouts. They had a third-party API that allowed you to connect up to it to initiate calls.
You could kind of make like little
contents,
and then you could add these little apps kind of, or open up a Hangout and kind of decorate it.
Yep.
With like being able to draw and things of that nature.
Right. And Google has quietly revealed that they're going to shut it down. They didn't do any blog posts or anything like that. They just kind of said to some users, yeah, we're not going to do it anymore. You look at the Hangouts API, it's just like, we're not going to do this anymore. It's going to be, they're not giving any new app IDs for working with it.
Okay.
And they're shutting down the existing apps on April 25th.
This April 25th?
Yeah. So it's another thing with Google. Google has never been good at long-term support with stuff. This was true with like Google Reader. It was true with not having to go through the laundry list of
there, no, it's too many to name, really. At the same time, okay, so I hearken to this project I've been mentioning in a few Geekspeak episodes, which is Firebase, and it's actually a whole platform development environment that Google's been surfacing on top of their Google app and cloud infrastructure system. And effectively, it gives you an ability to really quickly do authentication and database management and storage and access to other services, including wrappers for Amazon cloud services. And it's a great system. Like, I've been really happy with how quick it is to do things. I'm assuming they're going to hold on to that for a long time because they have a clear pricing model. Well, they make money off of it.
Google has a almost pathological focus on a singular idea, which is you have a billion people use the product or it's not worth it. If only a couple million use it, that's not enough. Drop it and spend those resources on something that a billion people will use. Hence, and that's their idea behind, like, they support Drive, Google Drive, and Google Apps, which have a huge user base.
Sure.
But Google Hangouts, that API, just didn't have the same user base, and they're trying to push
people...
But that's
the API of Google Hangouts. Google Hangouts itself is pretty popular in usage, yeah.
Google's a bit schizophrenic with regard to their apps. So, for example, they're trying to move people to another Google... app. I've forgotten the name of it off the top of my head.
They're getting rid of Google Hangouts?
Well, Google Hangouts is supposedly for their enterprise customers.
Well, yeah, and this is one of those things I was talking about with Firebase, is that I think it's safe to build off of Firebase because Google has a very clear model. At this price point, it's cost this much money. At this point, it costs, they're very clearly saying you're going to pay for the service. And assuming that they make some money off it, they're going to continue it going. But if you're saying that a million people or a billion people need to use it or they're not going to keep it, that seems like...
No, a million is not enough.
I know.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Duo is the name of the app that I was thinking of.
Duo?
Yeah.
So if they're going to do that, though, why would they ever write any kind of stuff for developers? You're never going to get a billion developers.
No, it's not. It's the platform to have a billion users.
What's it called? Duo?
Yeah.
Oh, Google Duo?
Yeah.
The simple video calling app. When did they launch this? God, they launched so much stuff.
Yeah. So I have no idea how good it is. I downloaded it, but I haven't actually used it yet because, you need to have someone else who has the app.
All right. We'll give it a shot. But they're even using the Hangouts icons in it.
So that's one of the drawbacks, and this is in contrast to Microsoft, that myself, along with a lot of other people, have derided for many years. But Internet Explorer, they stopped working on that years ago,
yeah,
and they switched over to Edge.
Yeah, sure.
And Edge has been very slow in getting gains. For one thing, Edge, really, you need to have Windows 10 now to get updates on that, which limits your audience off the bat. Internet Explorer was at something like 45% mm-hmm. of browser share in 2015 and then is now dropped to...
tremendously.
Basically nothing.
Thanks, Chrome.
Chrome is over 50% now. Sure. And at the same time, Microsoft still supports Internet Explorer. And
what
will
do you mean
for the
supports it?
Because people... Internet Explorer is not just the browser. It's also an API. It's also something that people will write to and
right.
have as a platform to work off of and integrate with their applications. And they aren't dropping that anytime soon. They still support it. They still provide patches for it. They still make the API stable and release new versions of the API. And
that's
Microsoft
kind of noble, right?
Microsoft historically has always done this. They have always been extremely stable with their APIs, always been extremely stable with their stuff, Silverlight notwithstanding. but, I mean, those are strong exceptions.
Silverlight's
for the
a
most
great
part.
Example, right? Sure, Silverlight's gone, but they gave a very long window to turn it off.
Right.
I mean, that you know, we're stopping Silverlight in 2 years, you have to get rid of it. It was kind of that kind of window. It was crazy long.
Right.
And Silverlight, of course, is kind of the flash competitor that Google created.
And we're providing migration tools and stuff like that for it. Yeah,
exactly. They even had really good patterns for taking Silverlight stuff and reworking it and compiling it for Windows 10 environment. The same stuff you built in Silverlight, you could then... And then, of course, you'd be writing in JavaScript, which is kind of cool because Windows 10 is like a JavaScript-friendly environment, operating system. Why is Google so... happy to just kill things off? Do they get rid of...
Because you can move faster.
Do they get rid of developers?
It's the same reason that Netflix didn't support the third-party API. It requires resources. It requires you to actually say, this is going to get nailed down, and then hold on to something that may not be optimal for an extended period of time for backward compatibility.
Is this what happened to Google Glass, for example? They just like...
Google Glass, the hardware, just did not sell well. They weren't able to iterate to get another revision that wasn't $1,500.
Well, yeah. I mean, they do have a whole business line side of that they're still kind of promoting, and there's business partners that are working with it. So it's not completely dead, but it's definitely not a success. But what I'm saying is that they kind of stopped doing it because it clearly wasn't going to be $1 billion thing or a billion user thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's the idea. Yeah. They weren't able to go anywhere with it.
What was the Google Glass talks when you worked at Google? Did you hear much about it?
No, by the time I got there, Glass was already on the decline. I saw in the code there were always the splits between this is what we're giving to a mobile user, this is what we're giving to a tablet user, this is what we're giving to a desktop user, here's what we're giving to a Glass user. And that Glass code was there, but it was going under severe bit rot, and we didn't test for it anymore.
Yeah,
there wasn't any active development going on for it
anymore. I still have a functional Google Glass, Miles. You helped hurt my glass. I'm upset at you now. I think that I found out from my niece who just started college. Sorry, my cousin who just started college, that she and her group of friends use a new video app, and it might have been Duo. I'll have to ask. I'm always curious about what the college set is doing. That's how I found out about Facebook and got an early invite to it. Or I should say before it was completely public invite. And the college kids seem to always be kind of on the edge of what's hip and cool, if you will.
This is where I see it's a shame that Google is – they're not getting rid of Hangouts or getting rid of the third-party API, but it's still – it makes people nervous.
Right.
Because I loved Hangouts and that it worked no matter if someone had an Android phone or a iPhone
or if
they were on the desktop or on a Mac or on a PC or on Linux. It worked.
Yep.
And so it was like FaceTime, only available everywhere.
Right.
And right now, it just so happens that most of my family and close friends are on iPhones, so we use FaceTime. But I know that... that's just an accident that we're
even
on iPhones.
I mean, whenever we record the show, we invite our patrons and stuff to, our higher paying patrons, if you will, to join us on Hangout, right? Google Hangout, because it's so easy to connect up and everyone seems to have an account and it's kind of like, why not? And if I have to say, if I wanted more of that kind of capability, I could imagine building on top of it. Though at the same time, I've never done any development on top of Hangouts. I forgot that it really even had a Layer API. But at the same time, we use it all the time at the office. Netflix runs on Hangouts. All meetings mm-hmm. have automatic Hangouts being generated.
Well, you would be the enterprise customer that right. they're not going to get rid of. Yeah.
Right. And they'll keep on developing extra features and stuff for the enterprise environment. Okay. Any case, I find it, it's, it definitely makes me doubt whether I want to use Google services and build off of them. Using them, fine. But investing resources and time to build on top of their platform seems a little sketchy to me. And that's why I'm wondering, is it a bad idea to invest in Firebase, for example?
Yeah,
what if they just turn it off next month? They yeah. could. And if I do a lot of development on it, then I'm basing my business off it, if you will, if yeah. I was doing business
or
off
just
it.
Looking to see like how much is this dependent upon Google doing it. Like, for right. example, the Cardboard VR. That is along the lines of, if someone makes a library that can split a screen and be able to program a parallax, it doesn't matter whether Google supports it or not.
Right.
That type of thing seems safe, sure. you know, coding for a VR environment. And it just comes down to, am I going to base my my business on this? How likely is it that Google not caring anymore about it will cause my company to not care about being in business anymore?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's definitely something you have to think about if you're using yeah.
Like I said, that's the contrast with Microsoft. In general, if you sign on to Microsoft, you don't have to – you have to worry about your own business concerns, but you don't worry about Microsoft pulling the rug out for you. They're known ills.
Yeah.
It's also an advantage. Sorry to interrupt. Also an advantage of the open source software. You get that. It's like that's always there. You always have the API.
I guess the thing that frustrates me about this, the Hangouts API, for example, is good. They decided to release a Hangouts API to let people develop stuff on top of it. Why? Why did they want to do that? What rationale do they have to invest in that? Just to see if it took off and got extremely popular?
Honestly, I think it had more to do with Google employees themselves.
Wanting to play?
Because, yeah, they would want to tweak with it. And so if you want to have integration, you're going to need to, with different teams, you're going to need to have entry hooks. So once you have certain entry hooks and you find common goals, it doesn't become that big a leap to be able to say, and here's a third-party API for other people to use because they may be interested in
sure,
it.
Sure, great. But call that a beta API. Say this is a beta API. Don't design your business around it. I mean, is there some guy that, you know, has been making sunglasses for Google Hangouts for a long time, you know, that auto-stick mm-hmm. and you could get customized ones for 10 cents for 10 or something like that? I mean, it could be that somebody spent a year working on developing on Hangouts and all of a sudden,
well,
screw
there
you
had Gmail was in beta for, what, 6 years or something ridiculous
perfect.
Like that?
Exactly.
Where there was a running joke that all of Google's products were in perpetual beta. And that in and of itself was hurting Google, try to get people on board because they're like, well, it's still beta. I don't know if I want to do this. And then finally Google went like, oh, screw this. Like, we're just going to have people come on
there.
Do you
think Google might turn off Gmail?
No, good Lord, no.
Will they turn off Hangouts?
Eventually I could see them saying, we have this other thing and I want you to migrate. Yeah.
Or like something like, you can use Hangouts, but there's a fee.
I don't see that. That hasn't been Google's modus operandi in general to change that free service over. I mean, Google Apps was kind of like that, but it hasn't been a general thing. In general, Google has made its user base the product and then used that for advertising.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know that we made it. I'd like to thank Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. And I'd also like to thank our patrons who support our show every day, but actually just monthly, with a little bit of money. If you'd like to do that, please visit us at geekspeak.org/support to learn more. And of course, spreading the word of GeekSpeak is also supporting us. So please feel free to write us reviews or tell people about our show, especially on news groups, especially if you've got a lot of friends. Miles, thank you so much for being here on GeekSpeak.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to episode 1 of season 17.